So I decided there's I think this could, we'll see how it goes, but I think this could be the last of the series, and I decided that we should talk about how we're also meant to be guru. And I think I've spoken about this, and I'm not sure if I spoke about this on this series or not, but I'm going to speak about it. And then I thought, if we actually finish this topic and nothing else really comes up that's necessary to talk about, then I could start doing a series on my experience with Prabhupada, personal experience, because I have recorded it, but I don't know if I've recorded it in length. And so I think it would be good to get that down. So at least we could do a few classes of what I remember, and that way I can get all my personal association done. I went to Rishikesh and I drank Ganges water straight from the river. That's a very good laxative, because after I drank it, you know what I had to do. So you can bottle it as a laxative and make a business. It's supposed to be very healthy, Ganga water from Rishikesh, but for me it was, yeah, it was a very good laxative. So, I thought if I speak a little bit about my experience in ISKCON as a young devotee, because I think it relates to the topic, and the topic of everyone should be a guru. And that was the amount of responsibility that one of the things is the amount of responsibility that Prabhupada was giving right from the very beginning. And as many of you know, and I've told before, that many, many devotees were given charge of temples. Usually those devotees had been in the movement about a year, and what was happening was that Prabhupada wanted to open 108 temples before he left. So Prabhupada was pushing that we open many temples. And as soon as we gather, usually one temple president and three devotees, then they would be sent to go somewhere. When I was a young devotee in the state of California, I think there was San Diego, Laguna Beach, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, I'm not sure if Santa Cruz, maybe San Francisco, Berkeley. So there's either six or seven, and I might be missing one. And on the border of California, there was Phoenix and I think Arizona. So just in a small area, there were like eight temples, because just sending, no, San Jose, yeah. So I was in San Jose. So San Diego, go 70 miles, Laguna Beach, go 70 miles to L.A., go 100 miles Santa Barbara, go 200, 180 miles San Jose, go 60 miles San Francisco, like that, just everywhere. So that's quite a big responsibility if you think about it for young devotees. Because temple president, in a sense, was like a guru, because he was responsible for the spiritual lives of everyone in his temple in some way, directly or indirectly. At least he had to make sure the temple was stable, the morning program was going on, the preaching was going on, and if devotees had problems, he would have to deal with it, or guide them, or be a counselor of some sort, right? So, of course, those temples were small, there weren't a lot of devotees, mostly it was just men. There weren't married couples. Life wasn't complicated, but still, Prabhupada was giving them that responsibility, so they had it. And as temples grew, then their responsibilities got bigger. As there was more grihasthas, more children, as it diversified, then there was more to deal with. So, right from the beginning, we can say, in a sense, Prabhupada was making everyone, or giving everyone huge responsibility. Now, he at that point in our society, he did not think we were ready to be guru. We could take the responsibility of temple presidents and leadership because Prabhupada was there. And so he was doing, you know, like he's running the business. So we can work in the business and the business goes well. We couldn't run the business. But we could take quite a responsible position in the business. Right? Yeah, so it was like that. So then, earlier on, several years before I became a devotee, Prabhupada had said something, and I found this letter. I'd like to read this to you. This is... No, this may not be... No, that's the wrong thing. Maybe I have another letter. This letter, this came later. But in about 1968, he said, said, all of you, you'll have to become guru. Now he says, this is 1975, I want to see my disciples become bona fide spiritual master and spread Krishna consciousness very widely. That will make me and Krishna very happy. So 1968, he said it. I don't have all the letters where Prabhupada is telling us to be a guru. But there is an interesting conversation in which Prabhupada was asked, what will please you? Or what will please you? And there's always this question, Prabhupada, what pleases you the most? And usually the book distributors would ask that question because they'd want to get Prabhupada to say book distribution, which would excite them and maybe help other people realize they should change their service or something like that. Or make other people feel bad. Maybe they wanted people to feel bad. And Prabhupada said, when all my disciples become spiritual master, that will please me the most. So that we're always getting from the very beginning. And of course, the idea of becoming Diksha Guru was something that was further off into the future. But the idea of being guru, which means to take responsibility for people, that was an immediate instruction. And then the idea of becoming guru, but it's given right in the very beginning. So even though we weren't ready, what it means is that Prabhupada's saying, this is what I'm preparing you for. So this is whatever you're learning, you will have to teach others. And I remember when I was a young devotee, sometimes they would ask you to do something you've never done before. And you would say, I don't know how to do it. And they would say, we're offering an arti. And they'd say, for the last 3 months, you've been going to arti every day and watching it, so you should know how to do it. So that was the mood. Like, I once asked a devotee, maybe it was Rasika once. We were in Mexico, and I asked her, maybe she remembers, to do arti or to do Tulsi Puja or something, and that's what I said. I said, but you've been watching it, so you should... Or somebody had to do something, I forget what. Said, you've been watching it, so you should learn by watching. So that was the idea that it was instilled within us that everything that's going on in the temple, you should learn how to do. And you're watching it, so you should study it and learn, because you will have to teach this. Or someday you'll have a temple, or someday you'll have disciples, and you'll have to teach these things. So that was right in the very beginning. So my point is that we understand that right from the beginning, Prabhupada's training us to train others. He's making the disciplic succession. And as we know, many times Prabhupada said, I'm an old man, you're all young, you have a long life ahead, I may leave at any moment. You will be the ones to carry on this movement. Now, we go back and we look at the history. And what's the history? The history, as we've discussed before, is Gaudiya Math was not able to take the movement out of India and do anything of any significance that would take root outside of India. So it was only Prabhupada's disciples that were able to do it. And therefore, we were the ones he was relying on. So he was relying on us to become gurus. He wasn't relying on his godbrothers. He tried to engage them, but it didn't work. So he was relying on us for everything. And right now I'm reading Jamuna's biography, and I'm on the section where they've just gone to London, so maybe they've just finally got the Burray Place Temple. So that's probably, they've been there about a year. And it was very difficult in the beginning, and Prabhupada kept saying, it will be successful. I'm counting on you, you'll make it happen. So he had these six Grihasthas who had been devotees at that point, probably 1 year, a year and a half, maybe 2 years maximum. And he was counting on them to spread Krishna consciousness in London, and he said, it will happen, persevere, don't give up, please cooperate, please tolerate, and it'll happen. And it happened, didn't it? Isn't that amazing? That's who he was depending on. He could not depend on his sannyasi godbrothers. He could depend on young grihasthas in their 20s. So that's how we understand this idea that Prabhupada's telling us, you become guru, you take on your disciples, because we were the ones that Prabhupada had. He didn't have anybody else. He couldn't depend on us. It's like, let's say, for example, you have a business and you want to retire from the business, but you don't want to give it up. You want to continue it. And you have some choices, and maybe there's a choice of someone who is more qualified than your son, but you don't feel you could fully trust this person, or this person really wouldn't fit into the dynamics of your company, but your son will, because you know he'll always do it the way you want, whereas the other person may do it a different way. So even though your son is less qualified, in a sense, he has the real qualifications that will make the company successful. So we were like that son. Prabhupada knew that we would follow what he wanted, and that's why he depended on us. And we've talked about this before. Because our power, our potency, comes not from our own qualification, but from following what Prabhupada wanted. So we may not be that qualified. But then here's the instruction. Then he gives the instruction, and because we follow that instruction, the instruction has the power. So Prabhupada trusted us. And so when Prabhupada's telling us, you become guru, he's saying, you take these instructions, you apply them, and then when you come to that point in your life where you become the living example, you become the living example of those instructions, then you can take your own disciples. But still, I think the important point is, prior to that, always this idea of be guru is there. And so, as I mentioned before, guru in that sense can mean taking care of people, taking responsibility. Like you are helping somebody, and as their guru, you help them in their life. You help them deal with whatever they have to deal with in their life, and you take responsibility. I'm bringing this person to Krishna consciousness. Now they have difficulty. I work with them. I'm in touch with them. I help them. I take them through stages of their advancement. So that's also the action of a guru, and definitely nobody could make any excuse and say, I can't do that. And when you become Jai. It already started. Yeah. So one of the things that we were talking about yesterday, well, not yesterday, but one of the things we were talking about that's very interesting is that you become guru not by votes, but you become guru because you're guru. So we're talking about all of you becoming gurus. You ready to become gurus? Yeah, see, I told a funny story before. I was in Nasik, I think it was 3 years ago. They invited me to Nasik. So I believe it was Ekadasi. we were there. It must have been Ekadasi or a specific day. And they, you know, some temples, once a week, they have a lecture of Prabhupada. So this lecture, Prabhupada was saying, all of you, you have to become guru. Have you ever heard Prabhupada say that? Prabhupada, he said it many times. All of you, you'll have to someday become guru. So, for those of us who are Prabhupada disciples, we understand that he's saying that, he's speaking that to 20-year-olds, 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds, who've been devotees for a few years. That's who he's speaking to. Which, from your perspective, doesn't really make sense, right? It didn't make so much sense to us, but we understood what Prabhupada was saying is that someday I won't be here. But for us, we thought he would live 100 years. So we thought, yeah, we'll have to be guru, but we'll be 50 years old then, right? Or something, you know, we never thought that he was going to leave so soon. So it was kind of like, you're 10 years old and your father's saying, you're going to have to take over the business. You don't worry about it because you're so young. So we didn't really worry about it. But he was saying it a lot. Not a lot, but he would say it. And one of the things that I began noticing today in ISKCON, that is very similar to what it was like in those days, that when we hear this, you have to become guru, it's like the father telling the 10-year-old, someday you're going to have to be a surgeon, you're going to take over my business. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah, whatever. You know, where's my bicycle? I want to go ride my bicycle. And so I was sitting in this class, and I had been thinking about this a lot, how really Prabhupada's mission was to train all of his disciples to be gurus. And I had been thinking about it in a way that I felt that somehow or other a lot of us didn't really get that that's what he wanted. I was saying before you came that Prabhupada was asked, what will please you the most? And he said, what will please me the most is when all my disciples become spiritual masters. So we didn't really get it. And then Prabhupada left, and then the disciples of Prabhupada's disciples, I can see, they're not thinking that way either, just as we weren't thinking that way. So I was sitting in the class, and Prabhupada mentioned this, you all have to become spiritual master. You know, it was on the video. And I looked around, and I could see on everyone's face, whoop, whoop, it went in one ear and out. It's just like, didn't make, you know those statements, you hear something from Prabhupada, It's so far beyond you, you can't make any sense out of it, so it kind of just dissipates in the air. It doesn't mean anything to you. It's just you don't know how to make sense of it, so it's almost like you don't hear it, because you can't do anything with it, because it doesn't make any sense. What will you do with it? You're going to have to become a surgeon. I'm only 7 years old. It doesn't make sense to you. It's just, you just forget it, right? So I distinctly looked around the temple when Prabhupada said that, and I realized that nobody got that. Not one person in that temple was thinking, someday I'm actually going to have to do this. I mean, I could guarantee you, nobody was thinking that way. And so this class is kind of to help us realize that a major part of Prabhupada's mission was to train preachers. And a major part of preaching is accepting disciples, even if you don't initiate them. It's just, you have to take care of people. Whether you're a bhakti riksha leader or just a friend, you have to take care of them. And when you came in, I was saying a really important point. And this has not manifested enough in our movement, and hopefully it will in the future become more of the way we understand guru. But when Krishna empowers you to help people, people naturally seek your guidance on a regular basis because you're helping them. And as they seek your guidance on a regular basis, you become a sort of guru unofficially. It may not be expressed, verbally, but if you look at the relationship and you look at the advancement and the dynamics of that relationship, you will see a guru-disciple relationship in many cases where it's not officially recognized because you're not in an official position, right, as a spiritual master. But if something quacks, it floats around in water and it's white, it's probably a duck, right? So if you're instructing somebody, they're taking shelter of you, you're helping them, you're setting an example for them, you're a spiritual master, even if you don't want to admit it or recognize it or say, no, I'm not, I'm just trying to help them. But that's what you are, right? So that's the broadest sense of spiritual master. You have the Vartma Pradarshika Guru, and you have the Siksha Guru, you have the Diksha Guru. And as we say, mother is guru for the children. So, you know, the dynamics of a mother-child relationship are obviously different than the dynamics of the Diksha Guru and the Siksha Guru. But fundamentally, the fundamental thread is Siksha. You're being instructed, they're dependent, you're guiding. So that dynamic pervades any kind of serious connection with a person where you're caring for them. And relationships naturally develop very strongly. I have a devotee who is very dear to me, dear friend, and he is making many devotees. And many of those devotees, he's encouraging them to see, or possibly see me as their spiritual master because he likes me. And so maybe seven of them or so. He brought to me and said, I said, here's your disciples. I never even saw them before. No. Here's your disciples. Oh, really? They're my disciples? I said, yeah, I've told them about you and they like you and they want you to be their spiritual master. But really, he's their spiritual master. The relationship that he has with them is much deeper because I just showed up. And to me that's awkward. I show up. It's kind of like you have a child and you bring it to me and go, here's your son. I said, what do you mean? It's your son. No, he's your son. It was very weird like that. So I could see with those disciples, it was so much different, the relationship, than with other disciples, because it was, the real connection was with him. It wasn't. They never really had a connection as deeply with me as they had with him. And that's natural that they would, because he's actually their guru. He's not initiating. He doesn't want to initiate. But he's actually their guru. He has all the symptoms of a guru-disciple relationship. And so a lot of times what we might do in ISKCON is not recognize that because somebody's not acting officially in that capacity. And then you recognize it only when it's official. But sometimes officially it's not even really existing because you're on other sides of the world or whatever, for whatever reason, you know. It's maybe existing more closely with someone you're in touch with. Or you may have a relationship with someone where it's very close. So recognizing that, then we go back to what Prabhupada's saying, where he's saying, I want you all to become guru, because it's natural. In the Christian religion, they have this thing called discipleship, that they tell people, go out and make disciples. Discipleship. So, we look at discipleship as like, what, you're going to sit on a big seat and have a Vyas Puja, you know, have your feet bathed wherever you go. That's not essentially what it means. It essentially means you're going to help this person in every aspect of their life. You're going to take care of them. You're like a discipleship is like a mentoring process. So now Prabhupada's saying you all become guru, and then you can choose how you do it. But for the movement to continue, it means there's going to be plenty of people who do that. Now you might say, I'm a pujari, that's not my service, or I'm a cook, or I'm a housewife with kids and so forth. But there was a book written, and it was a very popular book, it must come out a year or two ago, it's called Lead Without a Title. And the essence of the book is that everyone's a leader, because the mother's a leader for the kids, and everybody's a leader for someone, and your example is is part of leadership. So everybody is, right? So in some way, we're all examples, we're all leaders, in some way, we're all gurus, even if you're a pujari, but every day you wake the deities up, then you're acharya. You're showing us, you know, what is steadiness, you know. People will learn from you so much. But if we're talking more practically, and just say those who are the actual teachers, those are the ones who go out and help people. If you do it, and you do it well, and you do it over a long period of time, you develop relationships. And you actually become a guru. So in that sense, Prabhupada said, okay, everybody become a guru. But now, when we go into the realm of diksha, everything seems to change, but it actually shouldn't change. Let me read this to you. You will like this. This is a conversation in New York. It is the aspiring disciple who sows the seed in his heart, means his own heart. Or maybe I said that. No, they said, you know, you want the seed, but really you sow your own seed. Prabhupada said, if you have understood this Krishna philosophy, and if you have decided that you will take Krishna consciousness seriously and preach the philosophy to others, that is your initiation. I'll read that again. If you have understood this Krishna philosophy, and if you have decided you will take Krishna consciousness seriously and preach the philosophy to others, that is your initiation. My touch is simply a formality. It is your determination that is initiation. Right? So, this is the 20th lecture in this series we're doing. So we've discussed in great detail this particular, how this could be misunderstood. You know, initiation becomes something which we might think is distinct from what was already going on. But initiation is only a formalization of something that has to be formalized. If there's nothing to formalize, then what are you formalizing? Like, you don't like me and I don't like you, and now we're going to get married. There's nothing to formalize. There's no relationship, so why would you get married? Marriage is to formalize the relationship, right? If there's no relationship, you don't get married. So we say diksha is to formalize a relationship where a disciple has already accepted the guru, the guru has accepted the disciple. That's the real initiation. So that's going on all the time in ISKCON, where someone's accepting the shelter of someone else, and there's a relationship, and it's ongoing. There's all these bhakti viksha programs, they have leaders, or namhatas, or temple presidents. You know, there's relationships. I mean, they may vary amongst individuals, but some relationships get very strong. And that's essentially what a guru-disciple relationship is. So, but you were coming in, I was saying, well, how do you know a guru? How do you know a millionaire? Go check his bank balance. Are there 9 zeros after the first number? That's a millionaire. Well, 1 million rupees isn't much, but we're talking about, when we say millionaire, we talk about dollars, right? So, it's not a formality, you know. Okay, you rubber stamp him, now he's a millionaire. No, he has to have $1 million. That's what makes him a millionaire. So you are helping people. So how do we rubber stamp you? We don't have to. You have so many people are depending on you. You're guiding so many people. So that's what Prabhupada meant by being guru. And then, you know, and then from that, it naturally, the relationships naturally evolve, right? They become closer, stronger, more guidance. And you can be a woman, you can be young, you can be old. It doesn't matter. That's how Prabhupada had us spread Krishna consciousness. That's what we did. And we kept expanding. Open a temple, get a few devotees. Start a new temple, get a few devotees. All the senior people, the qualified people, they would go out. They would teach. They would make devotees. Right? Now, one of the things you'll find today in ISKCON, more so than I've ever seen it before, is how much devotees appreciate a variety of devotees who are helping them, not just one. Right? I have people tell me that. I don't even know them. But they read something, or they heard something or they've seen me on the internet or something. They say, oh, you've helped me so much. And I said, I did. I said, oh, yeah. I said, well, that's nice to know that I helped you, but I don't even know you. So, but that is just a reality today. And it's a reality which I think is natural. It's normal. That reality was somewhat suppressed in the early 80s because we felt it's only your guru that helps you, and anyone else is not really a guru. So we weren't recognizing what a guru-disciple relationship was, because it existed amongst many devotees, but it wasn't. It was thought that if you have more than one guru, then you're unchaste. So now it's much more natural, and people are recognizing, no, this is good and it's healthy. But my point is, when you teach, and you set an example, and you're inspired, people will connect to Krishna through you, and occasionally some people will see you as a guru or as a mentor or something. And so that's when Prabhupada said, when he told the Brahmin Korma, stay in your village and preach, become guru, that's what it means. So whether you initiate or not is really not the issue so much, but it's taking care of people. So when we say you should all become guru, just think that that's what Prabhupada wanted. Whether you're just taking care of your kids and the kids next door, or whoever you come in touch with, you help them become Krishna conscious. That's what it means to be guru. And that's when Prabhupada said that, I want you to become guru. In the broadest sense, that's what he meant. Now we get to the next stage. Well, then you might say, well, didn't he mean somebody's going to become Diksha guru? And he did mean that. But my point is that if an empowered devotee is preaching, then that empowered devotee will help others be Krishna conscious, and they'll naturally want to take shelter. And so they'll naturally ask for shelter and to formalize a relationship. And so that's what Prabhupada also wanted us to do. But it's natural. So why did he say, I want you to become guru? Because he knew if you're preaching, that's going to happen. Just to some of you, that will happen. It has to happen. Because you're guiding people, you're helping them. So some of them will want to formalize that relationship. And so now here comes the tricky part, and this is a very interesting part of the discussion. There is a Christian writer, well, I don't know if she's only a writer, speaker, maybe. I don't know her background. Her name is Marianne Williamson. She's quite well known in America as a religious teacher. A religious teacher, very broad-minded. I think she's Christian, but it doesn't come across as typical fundamental Christianity. And she said something which I like very much. And she said, you don't serve God by playing small. Playing small means, well, I'll hide in the corner. You know, you may be this amazing preacher. You may have the potential to preach to hundreds or thousands of people and affect them. But no. I don't want to do that. I just keep a humble position. And so she said, that doesn't serve God. I like that very much. Because as we know, Prabhupada was, he was always thinking big. And he liked that very much, that devotees would think big and do big things. And there was a story, South Africa, one of my dear friends, he went to South Africa probably 1980 or so, and he really, really opened it up in a big way. Where are you all from?
I'm from Pune.
Pune?
Karnataka, India.
Yeah, Karnataka. Mm-hmm. Where in Karnataka?
Near Udupi.
Oh.
London.
Manipal.
Oh, you? Oh, okay. Anyway, so I was just checking if anyone's from South Africa. So what they did at that time is, I'm not sure the details, but I think in a park or stadium or somewhere. I was just in South Africa. Somebody was telling me. I forget. Maybe it was a park. They had a Janmashtami program, I think with 50,000 people. That was like, in 1980, no temple had that many people. Maybe Maybe somewhere in India, I don't even think. That was huge. And this was 1977. So Prabhupada got the letter. He was so proud that his disciple did that. So you do something great, and Prabhupada was so pleased. So it's not that you shy away and say, well, I shouldn't do anything great, because really I'm not a guru, or I'm not a senior disciple, or I'm a woman, or I'm only 18. That wasn't how Prabhupada thought, right? But what he thought was, do something great, but don't think you're great. So that's the balance. But we think, I can't do something great, otherwise I'll think I'm great. So it's better I don't do anything great, that way I won't think I'm great. So, but that was not Prabhupada's mood. And you see how Prabhupada, he accepted worship, he accepted honor. Not because he wanted it, but because it was good for us. And that is probably, for a Vaishnava, one major austerity, that you have to accept honor and worship. Because a Vaishnava, he doesn't want to be honored. He wants to honor others. He doesn't want to be noticed. He doesn't want to be in the center. It's all in austerity. Right? So, in Prabhupada's statement that I want you all to be gurus, implied within that is that you may have to be honored and respected highly. So there was a morning walk, and either when Prabhupada came out of his car and the devotees greeted him, or when he went back in his car, the devotees said, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, I will be glorious when all my disciples are glorified all over the world. So he wanted his disciples and grand disciples to be glorified. He wanted us to do things which were glorious. And he didn't want us to shy away from that in the name of being humble. So being guru means you represent your spiritual master, you do what he did, you set his example, you teach what he taught, and whatever little success or great success, you're detached either way. You know, if you go to some parts of the world, you don't have a lot of success. It's not that there are not that many people coming to Krishna consciousness in certain parts of the world. It's difficult. But if that's what you have to do, that's what you do. You might, you know, spend 10 years there and have a congregation of 23 people. If you go to any city in India, you spend a year there, there's about at least 300 to 500 people the first year, right? The next year is like 2,000 the next year. I was just in a new temple. Wow. There's a new temple in Delhi, a place called Dwarka, I think it's called.
Yes.
And they have like congregation of like 2,000 or something. Yeah. Right? It's been there like a year, is it?
Just last year I've been there.
So the temple's been there a year and the congregation is 2,000. They're all new people. Isn't that amazing? So you go to a city in India 1 year, you build the temple, you'll have a congregation of 2,000 people. That's crazy. Right? You go to temples in America, they've been there for 40 years and they don't have congregations that big. So, you know, so it depends where you're preaching. But you may be in a situation where you become fabulously popular and you're just a humble sadhu. And you accept that with detachment because that's what it means. So I know a lot of devotees, when they hear this, become guru, that's the first thing. Well, I don't want to be honored. I don't want recognition. And so I have a little saying that you have to become detached from being detached. Because it's actually an attachment. You think it's detachment, it's actually an attachment. Well, I don't want to be honored. That's actually an attachment. But it looks like a detachment. So I say it politely, you have to become detached from being detached. But it's really, you have to become detached from being attached to being detached. You got that? Yeah. I don't want this. So it's like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, if Krishna wanted, I'd be prepared to have 100 children. So that's detached from being detached. Because he was Naishtiki Brahmachari and then sannyasi. So that's all about renunciation. And he's willing to renounce the renunciation if that's what Krishna wants. So a higher principle of bhakti, it's not about what you want. You know, I don't want a lot of followers. I don't want people to glorify me. No, it's not about what you want. Now, if you think, if I were in that situation, it would be difficult for my devotional service, okay, that's more reasonable. This could be difficult for me. But if it's about service, and it's more about likes and dislikes, like I can handle this, I just don't like it, then we want to consider a little bit beyond our likes and dislikes. Okay, maybe you'll never initiate anybody, that's all right, but you give people shelter, guidance, you help them, right? So that's the sense in which Prabhupada is telling us to be guru. And then the catch-22 is if you do that, then, at least now, for example, if a Prabhupada disciple does that, he said, okay, I won't accept disciples, but I'll give people shelter. Then at some point, many people may ask for initiation. So then he may, in some sense, be forced. And he will have to choose whether or not he wants to do that. But at least we will not see this as something we do because we want to be honored or gain something. But we see we do this only out of service because Prabhupada asked us to do it. So in some little sense, medium sense, big sense, this was Prabhupada's vision, that there would be thousands of people taking care of tens or hundreds or millions of people, right? And it has to be that way. And you can see now, what I think is really important now in ISKCON is for devotees like yourselves to become well-trained in taking care of devotees, because I see that many, many people need care, and they need care to deal with problems, and I see that a lot of devotees, they're not actually really that qualified to help people with their problems. They give sometimes advice which is very philosophically right, but it doesn't solve the problem. It actually sometimes makes the problem worse. Because you need practical advice. You know, you need, this is what you need to understand. This is, the police are after me. Must be my wife. No, it's some solicitor probably. Can't talk right now. Yeah. Yeah. So, what did I just say? The last thing? Oh, practical, yeah. So, what we see is, you know, everyone eventually who's serious about Krishna consciousness will want to take initiation, either now or 10 years, whenever. So that's recommended for all serious devotees. But if that happens, and tens of thousands of people come, they're not going to have much direct contact with their guru, unless there's thousands of gurus. So until there are thousands of gurus, who will they have contact with? They'll have contact with the people that have brought them in. There is a very, very famous Christian teacher. His name is Billy Graham. Have you heard of him? Billy Graham is like the most, he's like the biggest, they call him evangelist. He does all, at least what I know of him, at least today, if he's still doing it, or for the last decade or so, mainly, if not entirely, he would do, I think they call them revivals, but anyway, they're huge programs in stadiums. So stadiums hold 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people. And what the Christians do is they explain a few things, that you've been a sinner and that Jesus came to relieve you of your sins, and if you accept him as your personal savior, he'll free you from your sins and you go to heaven. It's pretty easy to sell that because all you have to do is accept. And, you know, they scare you a little bit about going to hell, and you don't really know where you're going to go when you die. But Jesus came because we're so fallen. It's kind of very similar to our philosophy. But we say chant Hare Krishna, they just say accept. And then if you accept him in your heart, he'll forgive you if you believe in him. So what he does at these revivals is he preaches that message very strongly to convince people. They're really, really good at it. And then, from what I've seen of how he does it, that the people that have come there, they've all been brought through different churches, so they have their leaders. So he said, if you want to accept Christ, come up with the person who brought you. So he never predominates that. He always wants the people to be connected with whoever brought them. So it's kind of like he's Acharya, you know, he's the one who got them to surrender, and now he's giving them to the local. So in a sense, he's like Guru Acharya, but then on the ground they have the different teachers. So unless we have thousands and thousands of gurus, that's how it will be. There'll be one guru, he'll be like Acharya, but on the ground, so many Siksha gurus. And the Siksha gurus need to become qualified. Right? They need to be able to practically help people. And pastors are trained to help people in every aspect of their lives. With their personal lives, their family, situations, career, spiritually, materially, every way they know how to help people. Because you can't separate one from the other, because your material and spiritual, they affect one another. So we need thousands and thousands of Siksha gurus who can help people. Yes? Not in a very deep, in a way as qualified as any other guru. Yes?
In Pune, we have a
counselor system. Yeah, well, that's my point. I have observed that if you're going to become a counselor, ideally you need to be expert in dealing with all these things, because you run the chance, if you're not, of giving the wrong advice. You know, and people have so much trust in spiritual authority that even if you give the wrong advice, they'll take it as the right advice and they'll do it, and it could create a problem. In Western culture, that's called pastoral abuse. That you're counseling somebody and you're giving advice in an area that you're not expert. And you may tell, you know, say, I think you should divorce. I think you should quit this job. I think you should move from this city. You know, all these things that could be disruptive. I don't think you should talk to your mother anymore. She's a bad person. So it's quite a responsibility. And that's why I said we don't just need counselors, we need qualified people. But my point is, as you remain in ISKCON and teach, and if you want to teach, you're going to hit a point where people are going to come to you with these problems. You're going to have to give guidance, because everybody has certain problems in life, right? Of course, there's some guidance you can give from your own experience. That's there. But you want to become qualified. So the more you're in a position to give guidance, the better, the more you need to learn what does our philosophy teach about this, and what is practically common sense understanding? Because a lot of times you can read the philosophy and you come to a conclusion which is not actually what Prabhupada wants. It's just you have a certain angle on it. Your experience may be limited, or it just may be your nature that this is how you see things, and it may not be the right answer. So we have to be careful, because philosophy, it exists as a theory, but when you put it into practice, that's where you could misunderstand or misapply. So I find personally, for me, one of the things I love to do is to read about Prabhupada, especially how Prabhupada applied Krishna consciousness to people who are coming new. How liberal he was and how open he was, because he really saw the main thing was to get them into Krishna consciousness and encouraged. He wasn't fanatic, he wasn't heavy, he wasn't black and white. He never made them feel bad, he never made them feel there was something wrong with them. Now, if you could go to our philosophy, if I took our philosophy and I put it against your life, I could make you all feel really bad. See, you're not doing this, you're not doing that. Don't you understand this point? It says right here, you're not your body. Why are you so worried about how you look? You know? What do you care, you know? What color sari you wear, what color earrings you wear. But this is all, of course, all normal, right? It's normal. We've been in Bali concept forever. So it's normal we care how we look. We care about our health, because if we're not healthy, we're not going to be able to be Krishna conscious. We're not that transcendental. But an immature person could apply the philosophy in a way to make people feel bad or even become discouraged in a sense. So I find it extremely valuable to see how Prabhupada dealt with different people in different situations, as I learned so much. And one of the things that I saw, which is very, very important for any kind of teacher, preacher, counselor, mentor, mother, father, is that Prabhupada was completely accepting of people's failures. He was completely accepting of people's frailties. The only areas which he was strict on is if he gave you a specific instruction and you just didn't pay attention and you did it wrong. Or you promised to do something, you didn't do it. But as far as your personal weakness, if you failed, let's say, following a regular principle and you came back and said, you know, I ran off with this woman, you'd say, then marry her and do your service. It was like, it's over. You know, that was it. That's all you'd get. Okay, go on, go forward. Or go back, if you were married, go back to your wife, forget this, just drop, go back to your wife. It was like the past was over. It was always forward. We're moving forward. He never made you feel bad. He said, I hope you've learned your lesson, you don't do this again. It was all forward. That's how Prabhupada was. He was so accepting. And he also understood that encouragement was extremely important for people, because Maya is so discouraging to us. Because if you try to get up, Maya just keeps knocking you down. You know, yeah, I tried to get up early, but I promised myself I'd get up early, but I didn't, and I'm discouraged. You know, and you know, I listened to this lecture on good japa, then I tried to chant, but I got distracted by my things I have to do at work today, and I'm so, you know, it's always this. There's always so much negativity. Yes, that's just like the nature, right? So Prabhupada was always encouraging. Always encouraging. Whatever you've done, very nice, thank you, that's very good. You're thinking, that was horrible. And he's thinking, no, that's very nice. Keep up, keep, continue in this way, right? So, I think that's a very important example for preachers, because you have this sensitive job of encouraging and accepting and at the same time guiding and directing and correcting, right? But if you look at Prabhupada, you'll see the encouragement, the positive guidance and the acceptance predominated, and the correction was the exception, right? You look at some people, correction is the main thing, and encouragement, positive guidance and acceptance is the exception. But that's not Prabhupada's example. So that's one way we learn how to preach. What's one way we learn how to counsel? And so we understand people need to be appreciated, they need to be encouraged, they need to be loved, they need to be accepted. Otherwise, they don't do well. Right? I mean, you know, some people are just, they're hard like a rock, you know. But you will find amongst the early devotees, if you ask them, what kept you in Krishna consciousness? Let's just say Prabhupada's affection. Now, I was listening this morning, or last night, I was listening to a talk by one of my godbrothers, and he said something really nice. He said, one thing about Prabhupada is that you knew that he would never, ever do anything to harm you. He only had your interests in mind. And because of that, you could give yourself, right? So that's another aspect of a preacher, counselor, mentor. That the person you're mentoring, counseling, guiding, they feel you only have their interest and you would never do anything to harm them. So, you know, we don't speak ill of anyone behind their back, so forth. So, you see, all these skills are skills which are not skills about exactly what you say, but it's skills of how you think in terms of other people. And then naturally you'll say the right thing. Yes? If you have that mood, you say the right thing. So that's very important, right? And then secondarily, as I was saying, then let's say you're counseling, right? And you start to realize that in your counseling, there's a couple things that keep coming up. They're repetitive. You know, people tend to be negative with themselves. They tend to focus on negative things. Or relationships with kids are difficult, or husband and wife. You know, it's usually very common. And so you realize that I'm counseling a lot of people, and this keeps coming up over and over and over and over and over again, that I should learn. So I have to be expert in these areas to deal with this, because it keeps coming up. So that's also what I'm saying is that we don't have enough gurus to go around, but the disciples should be as good as the gurus, or even better in certain areas, where the guru just says, I can't even deal with this. This is like, so okay, you become expert as service, you know, to your guru. And that's very important. So we don't give instruction, we don't throw philosophy on top of something that needs a different approach. Once you solve it, then the philosophy takes it to the next level. But sometimes the philosophy won't apply directly, because the issue is not philosophical. It's more practical or relational. It needs little surgery. And if you read Prabhupada's letters, you'll see so many instructions. Just please cooperate. Wasn't a whole philosophical talk that, you know, devotees cooperate. It's in this verse. Just please cooperate. If you don't cooperate, we can't progress. I'm depending on you. Working together. Please be humble. You know, like that. Simple. Somebody here, Krishna Kirtan, is saying, I understood you receive training outside to become a qualified counselor. However, in ISKCON, gurus name some of their dedicated disciple to act as counselor without deep training and qualification. So what is your advice for proper training in this field and avoiding pastoral abuse? Very good question. I understand you have seen personal training outside ISKCON. Would you recommend that? Yes, I would. Or I would recommend, well, what I try to do is give that training to devotees in ISKCON so they don't have to go outside. But there are limitations. Okay, you're asking me that I did training outside is I was just interested in it. Well, simultaneously I saw the need for it, but I was personally interested in it for myself. And then I saw the need for it with other devotees. And devotees would come to me with problems that they didn't need another shloka from Bhagavad Gita to solve the problem. They needed something much deeper. And I wanted to be able to deal with that, and I felt dissatisfied if I couldn't. So I did a lot of training, but I did a lot of personal study also. And I found it beneficial. And a lot of gurus will tell their disciples, go see Mahatma. They're dealing with something, they'll send them to me. Because they know that I studied this. But what I'm saying is, gurus should have a lot of people like me who have studied these things, who are qualified. And that if you're going to be seriously mentoring on a personal level with difficult problems, you either have to learn it, or you have to have someone you can go to and say, go talk to this one, rather than try to flow, you know, somebody's suicidal and you throw a philosophy, you're not the body, that's not going to help. You have to intervene because something's going on psychologically and emotionally that has to be corrected. Right? So, I mean, you know, with some people it's kind of a temporary thing, and maybe philosophy would help. But if it's a serious ongoing problem, it requires more. So we have to have people trained like that, because many, many, many of the problems we're all dealing with are not philosophical misunderstandings. They're internal imbalances, or anarthas, we call them anarthas, that are blocking us. And we have to have somebody expert enough to help us deal with it. Now, I'm not saying philosophy won't deal with it. In many cases, that is what we need. But in some cases, it's not the only thing. So, She says, Srila Prabhupada's example and teachings are not so available to the second generation. They mainly rely on their guru, how to bring the maximum number of persons to their guru, not always for people's interest, what to do. I'll read that again. Prabhupada's example and teachings are not so available to the second. I think you mean, they're available, but they're maybe not. I think what she's saying, what we were Prabhupada disciples, that's the only teaching we got was from him, you know. All the recordings were his. So she's saying second generation is not getting that. They're getting more from their guru. And then they tend to bring persons to their guru. So what to do? Well, I think the GBC and other divisions of ISKCON is dealing with this. And the guru and disciple course is one way they're trying to deal with this. Two, and the Prabhupada, our founder Acharya course, that's also another way we're trying to keep Prabhupada in the center of the wheel, and all the other teachers and gurus are the spokes that connect and make that more prominent. And there are GBC resolutions that disciples should not canvass for their guru. They can invite people to hear their guru. They can do so many things, but they should never say, you should take initiation, or they should never do something subtly where they really have not been exposed to anybody else, so naturally they will take initiation. So it's not healthy, and so the movement is working, and they have resolutions against this. It happens, it still happens, it still goes on, but that's something beyond me. I don't deal with it. I know also, I think there's very few gurus, if any, that actually try to do that consciously, like coerce people to become their disciples. It may have been a problem previously, but there are situations naturally where a lot of people are disciples of one guru, and so that's who they become. They become disciples of that guru. But the GBC is trying to open that up so people make decisions on their own. Not because everyone else is doing it, you do it. You do it because that's your decision. Of course, you could condemn us, say we did make a decision to take Prabhupada as our guru. He was the only one. And we were just told to take initiation. This is who you're taking initiation from. So that wasn't bad. So, you know, in a sense, If you're in a, like what I call the conveyor belt, you know, you go with the Bhakti Riksha, and everyone in the Bhakti Riksha is taking Diksha from this one guru. So, you know, you're a new devotee. What do you know? You don't go on the internet and say, you know, let me look at every website of every guru in ISKCON to see if he's better than this one. You just do it. And so in most cases, it's not a problem because that's a wonderful guru and he's bona fide. But sometimes down the line, people will say, well, I didn't really know what I was doing, and had I known, I may have made another decision. That's unfortunate, but still you have a bona fide guru, and you can take siksha from that other person anyway. So it's not a disaster, but it's just not ideal that you're not making the decision yourself. And so the Guru Disciple Course very clearly articulates this. The GBC articulated in a resolution. You cannot... Disciples nor gurus are not allowed to canvass. And there is definitely concern about the conveyor belt, because there is definitely conveyor belts going on all over ISKCON, where 99.99% of the people, or 90% of the people, get diksha from one guru, who they have very little connection with after the diksha. I know that because people... I have very unusual experiences where people take shelter of me and tell me things like, you're my inspiration, it's only because of you that this happened in my life. And then later on I find out, they say, I'm so happy to let you know I just got initiated by so-and-so, which confuses me. But, you know, for the last year you're saying, and then they say, and it's only your mercy that I got initiated, and it's only your instructions that keep me going in Krishna consciousness, and just please, I have to, you know, you allow me to write you and please guide me. It doesn't make sense to me, you know, because I feel that's kind of unnatural, you know. Anyway, it's going on, but at the same time, they're fine because they took shelter of an empowered guru who's got thousands of disciples, an incredible devotee, more incredible than I am. So it's all good. But I just, when that happens, I kind of feel like, it's just really the person you wanted to take initiation from? Because you're telling. So I don't think, I mean, I think it's good that they have that sentiment, but I think maybe there's something wrong with that. So there are many senior devotees who have concerns about this. Now, like I just want to say, I don't think the result is bad. Teachers who've taught the disciple course have told me, people have come up to them and said, I made the wrong decision in choosing my guru. They may not have been on a conveyor belt. It just may be they have been young devotees. But you know, so we want to avoid that. But if that is the case, where you feel like, it, had I known or thought about it, I would have taken shelter of another guru, that's fine. Take shelter of it. It's okay. Your Diksha guru is happy. So it all has a happy ending, but we'd rather have a happy beginning and ending. And if you are on a conveyor belt or were on a conveyor belt, I don't want to make it sound derogatory. I just, it's, you know, I'm sure everyone on the conveyor belt is doing wonderful, because I've been to conveyor belt temples and parts of the world, and everyone's doing fine. They're all blissful. They're associated with all their god brothers and god sisters. It works. But in the long run of ISKCON, over the next 10,000 years, we don't want to do it that way. Because Shastra says, you as an individual, you find your guru, you check your guru out, and you make a decision. That's what we want to come to. So, I don't know if that answers the question. You had someone? Yeah.
Suppose somebody aspiring from Ramanath Swami from Pune. So, first thing they'll say, before you aspire, we would like to clear with you, don't expect that you're going to meet Maharaj personally.
Yeah.
There's no chance. And if anything in the counseling system is there, you can talk to us. We can, if you wanted to say something, we are there to deal with you.
Yeah, that's good.
And Raghunath Maharaj already said, all messages and my instructions are there in my lecture.
Yeah.
So nothing personally, something you need to come and talk to me.
Yeah.
If you go to Chaupati temple also, still don't find that you will be able to meet Maharaj. You can see Maharaj.
Yeah, right.
So they, beforehand, they make
unless you corner him.
Yeah, unless you're somebody very close or something, you can.
But unless you're an American, then you can.
Yeah.
If you're in India, no.
It's not.
If you take birth in as an American in your next life, then you can. Or maybe a Russian, yeah. But not in India. Yeah.
So they can accordingly say, after hearing also, if they are perfectly fine, because I know many of my friends, they are disciples of Maharaj. Till today they have not met Maharaj.
Yeah.
They are not even spoken. But they feel like giving some gift to Maharaj.
Yeah.
They feel like talking to Maharaj.
Yeah.
When they come in, my spiritual master comes and comes by Maharaj. Is it Tulsi Priya, can I come and serve your spiritual master? Can I come to your house? Can I do some service? I was like, fine, please come with Prabhu Mahārāja, otherwise
the thing is, you have people that are so inspired by him or Jaipatak Maharaj or any guru that they're not going to be able to interact with personally. They're so inspired, they can't imagine taking diksha from anybody else, even if they're not going to have that personal association. And then you have the opposite. You have people that can't imagine not having personal interaction with their guru. That doesn't make sense to them. So then they wouldn't want to take initiation in that situation. I mean, I know many like that.
But is that the feeling that come later on, that's not good?
Is what?
I mean, after taking initiation, I'm just giving an example. If somebody after taking and then feel, I wish I would have taken from somebody, so I would have got that accessible the way she is getting accessible to a spiritual master.
Mm-hmm.
That feeling, it's too late to feel that way. I mean,
well,
is that correct to be getting that feeling?
It's not, she's asking, If you've taken initiation from your guru and then you regret because you can't, you want that personal, is it too late to feel that way? That's an interesting question, because you already feel that way. So you can't, you can't control how you feel. That's just how you feel, which means that feeling is directing you to want to take personal guidance. So in that case, you would want to find a sixth year guru where you could get more personal guidance because you feel you need it. But what I would say is that this is what I would do if I were a counselor, and I don't know if this is done. I would say, as you said, I said, you know, you're not going to get personal association, and there are many gurus who don't have a lot of disciples who could give that to you, or even some who have a lot who can give it to you, but it's not humanly possible for him to do it. He has too many disciples, and his services in spreading Krishna consciousness to newer people. So you just have to make sure. You have to consider, you know, that if you want more personal guidance, either you're going to have to take a six-year guru, or you'll have your mentor, or take a six-year guru, or you may want to look for a diksha guru who can give that to you. So that's what I would say. For personal.
Yeah.
I mean, you may even have a counselor, and you may feel like the counselor is good, but so and so Maharaj, if I could accept him as my sixth guru, I think that would help me even more. Counselor has his limitations, but Maharaj is, you know, he's amazing. So that's there also, right? So, you know, people are going to feel different things, and you can't control how they feel, and everybody's different. I was with a devotee. He was in Israel, and Burijan Prabhu visits Israel, and he's initiating a lot of devotees, Giriraj Swami also. And he was thinking of initiation with Burijan. He said, but I feel for Radhanath Swami something so special. And I said, you know, he's never going to come to Israel, and you may never see him. And he says, I don't care. I just feel that, right? So everybody's different. And someone else is going to say the opposite. Unless I can be with my guru and travel and talk to him and write him and get a reply, I don't want a guru like that. I can't. So as long as people... See, the point is people have to know when they're getting initiated what's actually happening. And my personal opinion... no, actually, I can't say this is true. But I think in some cases, if people had a connection personally with a guru, then they might switch it around and say, I want Radhanath Swami as my Siksha Guru, but I want this person as my Diksha Guru. They might do that if you gave them the opportunity, because they're the kind of person who needs that personal association. Right? So I've seen both people. I've seen the person who just to be initiated by such an exalted person, that's like all they need. And they're just happy with the local guidance. And other people, no, I need my guru to give me guidance, or a Siksha guru, or Radhanath Swami, or Jayavataka Maharaj, or Indrajyotsna Swami. He's my Siksha guru, but personally you can have many Siksha gurus. So that's what the GBC, and that's what, you know, the educational departments, that's what they want to bring people to, so they don't want them to just, everybody's doing this, so I do it. And then, you know, 10 years later, they think, why did I do that? Which, as I say, well, it's not such a problem because you can get a six-year guru, but you want to make sure. So you see, because according to Shastra, it says you take a guru because of compatibility. You study him and say, is this the right person? Does this work for me? So at least you want people, you know, to know. This is not the only person. You know, there's so many, there's 100 more out there, right? And even now, for example, another thing I would tell them if I were in this situation, I said, you know, he's spending most of his time in America. You're not going to see him that much here unless you go to America. So as long as you're, you know, if you're completely inspired just by the association of all the God brothers, the temples, the lectures, his books, go for it. There's no problem. Just as long as they know the whole picture. And if ever at a point they come and they say, I really need personal association, or I heard so-and-so Maharaj speak and I was just amazed, I feel such a connection with him, say that. Ask him to be a six-year disciple, no problem. One more. Let me. There's one here. There's two here before you ask.
Okay.
I like the point about encouragement of Srila Prabhupada. In Prem Bhakash's point, I have taken more risk to preach when I feel so unqualified after someone I trust gives me encouragement. It's what he's saying. If someone encourages him, then he'll take risks to preach because he'll do what's maybe impossible. I asked another devotee asked a question, Krishna Kirtan, and I said, did it answer it? And she said, yes, you've answered the first question nicely. We seem to be going in the right direction, taking lessons from past mistakes. So ask your question. You can see me and I can't
yes.
see you. The lights went out. I guess they could tell the lights went out because they can't see me either. If I go like this, they can see me because they get light from my computer. Oh, this is fun. It looks like a horror movie now. Oh, wow. You should see this. It is like a horror movie. I can go in and out. Wow. Oh, I'm going to get light. It's going to shed light on me. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Well, stand there. I'll tell you where it's good. That's better. Well, come closer. That's better. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Okay, yes, question.
My question is, I was discussing with my husband, when we saw Radhanathan in Chaupati Temple, like Maharaj's potency so much there in Chaupati Temple.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's flourishing like anything.
Definitely.
The devotees are really going out. So,
yeah, go ahead.
Is that I think if every sannyasi take up, I mean, feeling that if any like sannyasi take up one temple, make it base, and if they it can come lots of changes in the temple congregation.
Yeah.
You know, if they take up one, of course they must travel. It's not saying they should not, but like how Radhanath Swami Maharaj, how he has taken up, I know 6 months he's there. Of course now he reduced like anything. Because he used to be 6 months in India, six months in the US. And now we feel that I should go more to the US, they need me more. Because they already, Maharaj already made them so strong, this congregation.
Yeah.
See, Maharaj's absence also, they are doing quite good. So even I feel if any others, sannyasi take one temple of the base, and they spend
their own
so
temple,
much time.
Spend time. Yeah, everyone would take initiation from them. That's
but,
what you're saying?
Sorry?
You're saying if a sannyasi had their own temple, everyone would want to take initiation from them?
Natural? At least they spend a couple of months, so we make them strong, some congregation, and they can do a good training. And like how what is happening in Chapati? Same thing is happening in every temple, so it would be a very nice offer.
Still, what ISKCON is trying to do is keep the movement from being 100 different movements. So what you said could create 100 different movements. Possibly. You know that? You take 100 gurus and they start 100 temples and then everyone in each temple becomes only their disciple. Then you actually have 100 movements. And we already had. We had 12 movements after Prabhupada left. So it's an interesting discussion because on one hand, we want to make sure that it's Prabhupada's temple and Prabhupada in the center. And on the other hand, when you have empowered people, naturally everybody wants to take initiation from them because it's their temple. So it's not right or wrong either way. It's just whatever... What ISKCON is saying is at least devotees are educated so they know this decision to take Diksha is your decision. And it should not be forced by culture, subtle pressure, because there's a lot of subtle pressure. You know, if you're in a bhakti riksha and 99 out of 100 people are taking initiation from one guru, that's a lot of pressure to make you feel that if you don't, people are going to look down at you. Right? So we've had situations where that happened and it was resisted by the leaders. Why are you taking from somebody else? And that's what the movement's trying to avoid. Because Because they want you to make the decision, and they don't want you 10 years later to say, I just did it because everybody else did. And now you say, well, would you have made that decision if, now? And you might say, I'm not sure I would. We don't want to create that. As I said, for many devotees, that'll never be the situation. They'll never regret it. They'll think, this is wonderful. I love my spiritual master. Everything's great. Right? So that's the idea of education, just to let people know, this is your decision. You don't have to take from this person. If you do, we understand why you're doing it, because you want to. You're not going to be able to talk to him. You accept that. You know, at some point in your life, you may need to seek your guru. That's fine. You can accept. You may want, but as I would say you may want to consider. There are gurus that have 100 disciples. You will see them. You will talk to them. They're not part of this temple. They may come. They may not. So you know, there's so many considerations. That's what's being taught. That you make a decision, and so there's concern if you go into situations where there's only one guru. There's concern. That's like it's an institution amongst itself. Everybody's Krishna conscious. Nobody's arguing that. Nobody's arguing the qualification of the individual. And we can understand the unity that's there. We can understand in a sense why you may not want a lot of gurus there. It may confuse things. But as this gun grows, we want to make sure it grows in a unified way. And if we had 1,000 gurus, one guru wouldn't have to have so many disciples, right? But we don't, right? So these are all things that are being discussed right this last week, being discussed. And they've been discussed for years. And they're even discussed outside of GBC meetings in people's homes. And everybody talks about it. You know, it's a big concern. So we're trying to understand it, balance it, deal with it, you know. Now, you know, traditionally a guru was someone who sat in an ashram and trained his disciples. You know, so there are people who question the idea of a guru who doesn't train his disciples. You know, why do we want that? You know, they're not personally training them. They don't know. They don't know your problems. They don't know what your challenges are. So that question is there sometimes also in people's minds. Is that the future of ISKCON, where you have gurus who really don't know what their disciples are doing? I mean, I can guarantee you, I know way more about a lot of people's disciples than they do, because they come to me. Because their guru, as you said, he can't talk to them. So people will question, well, then what is the function of a guru? Now, someone may say the function is to inspire. He's this powerful person, he's inspiring. And then the instructions personally, and he's getting general instructions, and the personal instructions you'll get from counselors and other such groups. And so that's one idea. Another idea is a lot of gurus with not large numbers of disciples where they can take care and train. And they can all serve more closely. So I think there's value in both. And we're going to have to see how it evolves, because a lot of it's practical. That means if you're going to work with your guru and get trained by him, you all have to live in the same place. Then he can't travel. And he's a sannyasi, he's going to travel. So that means it's got to be, then you got to take from a grihastha guru who sticks in one place, has his own ashram, and doesn't go anywhere. Okay. So, can we end now? Or is there anything else? Did I upset anybody?
Not at all.
These are just the discussions that are going on. But as leaders, that we have to consider that. You know. I have I had an interesting conversation with a devotee I respect, and I had a question in my mind, is that sometimes a disciple may think about taking initiation from a guru, and sometimes I sense that it's not a good combination, because I know the person and I know the guru, and I could see that they actually, you know, you're like this and he's like that. He's really strict and you're kind of a free spirit. And I don't know if in the long run it's going to work. So I asked him, do you say anything? When someone has faith in a guru, I said, do you say anything? He said, no, I would never stand in the way. He said, it's like don't stand in the way between husband and wife. So I respected that, that it's the disciple's decision. He may ask questions. Why this guru? Are you sure? Have you seen other gurus? You know, but he'll never say no. Or I think this guru would be better. I mean, as a father, you might do that. Whereas my daughter just accepted someone as a guru. She didn't ask me or my wife. She just did it. So sometimes it's like that. I think she made a good choice. So I respected that. That you don't, you know, you don't want to push people in a certain direction, and you don't want to push them away from a direction. You just want to help them understand what is a guru, what is a disciple, and how to make a decision. That's the idea. Yes? Okay?
Sure.
It's good? Okay. We can end on that happy note. And if your guru has 10 million disciples, you can always, there's always 6-year gurus for you. If you think I need personal association with a guru, you can, there's always 6-year guru, or you can always accept that guru with 10,000 disciples as your 6-year guru, and you know, there's so many combinations, so many choices that can work. Okay?
There should be some training before taking initiation.
That's the disciple course.
Yeah, which we have come up in Pune Temple, we started.
Yeah, that's the GBC's effort to deal with this. I've just given about 30 hours of classes on this topic also, given, you know, the whole history and to help. So the more of us that can give this education, the better. The more the top. The Founder Acharya course is very, very, very helps in this direction, because you really get a founding in who Prabhupada is. So, you know, we don't want to create cults around different gurus. We're trying to keep unified. That's the idea. Okay?